Thank you very much, Johnny. Excellent, excellent presentation. If we had a couple of people like him in every major community, we'd be fluoridated throughout the nation. And he learned on the job. You know, anyone can become a fluoridation advocate. We should all be fluoridation advocates. Hmm? Even a Republican. There we go.
And I'm staying Republican, even though I don't agree with them.
Thank you very much. Excellent. Our next presenter, Dr. William Moss. Bill is a public health consultant, and I guess that means he's semi-retired, or whatever. He's an appointment as a clinical professor at the University of Maryland School of Dentistry. For the past 6 years, he has been serving as the advisor of the Pew Charitable Trust Campaign to change state and federal policy to improve access to dental care for disadvantaged children. Prior to this, he had a career in the U.S. Public Health Service, I think, which we're all familiar with. But for over a decade, he was with the Centers for Disease Control, the director of the Division of Oral Health. Bill has been very involved with a variety of issues nationally. And in the last number of years, he's been very helpful for those on the local and state level fighting for fluoridation. And I'm very pleased he was able to come. He came right from the airport to our session. He made it. Bill Moss, let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you, Myron. So my task was to, I have no relationship with any way to make money off of water fluoridation either. My task was to talk about national lessons learned, but actually, as Dr. Gooch mentioned, with the exception of the recommendations from CDC, there is no national fluoridation policy. These decisions are all made at the state and local levels, which is the reason we get this kind of disparity in the nation, with 10 states providing fluoridated water to over 95% of their residents that are on community water supplies, and then 10 others with a far different coverage of their population. So that doesn't mean, though, that we can't learn lessons from these state and local efforts and apply them nationally. I'm also going to take a look at this from the perspective of the last 6 years of experience with the Pew Children's Dental Campaign. With a reminder that at the time it was started, it was housed in what was then called the Pew Center on the States. And the four policy areas were included, one on community water fluoridation. So in preparing for this presentation, I went back through our notes, and in June of 2009, which was during the first year of this campaign, we oriented the American Dental Association's National Fluoridation Advisory Committee to what Pew was planning. And this was what we anticipated our activities would be. We actually thought we would promote some statewide mandates, either legislative or regulatory. We'd look for some ways to provide incentives to local communities, and then we'd assist in research, education, and messaging in response to the anti-fluoridation movement. Now, the state-level activities, you'll notice that the word fluoridation doesn't occur here at all, because this, in fact, is the approach that the Pew Center on the States used for every policy campaign that it had. So we were basically applying lessons that had been learned by the Pew Center of the States, working on policy change at the state level, knowing that these were all the steps that would have to be taken to be successful. And we were also cautious. This is what we told the ADA's Fluoridation Committee, that we weren't going to get involved in a state campaign until we knew what we were doing and how we were going to do it, and who we were going to do it with, that we'd have the resources and that the time was right to do it. We always talk about this kind of issue being ripe. And we wanted to make sure that whatever we did would impact enough kids and lead the way for other states. Now, in spite of that caution, these are the states that Pew has worked with over the last 6 years. And the reason for the caution is twofold. One, you don't want to lose a campaign because it has a lot of precedent and has a lot of ramifications. The other is to realize that the Pew Children's Campaign was funded with a 2-year grant from the Pew Charitable Trusts, what they call trust-operated projects. While the projects are operated by employees of Pew, it's soft money, just like the grant you might get from a funder. And if Pew was unsuccessful, did not follow the guidance that I showed on the previous slide, that dental campaign would not have been funded to address community water fluoridation after that first 2-year period. And actually, while we were reviewing options for state action, we were invited into campaigns at the local level. And lessons were learned from each of these. I won't go into details. We can go over that later in the questions and answers. Certainly for me, one of the lessons was that in Wichita and Portland, the communities that probably would most likely benefit from water fluoridation were either uninterested or actually hostile to water fluoridation. And so while San Jose has been successful in getting a commitment of several entities, water utility entities, wholesalers, to make progress towards the substantial financial commitment that will be needed to fluoridate, decisions both in Wichita and Portland, we were left with public referenda, and it'll be very difficult to go back to either one of those communities probably for at least another 10 years. Meanwhile, we did have a successful effort at the national level with the Department of Defense. A public health dentist you may know, Colonel Gary Chad Martin, worked nonstop on this issue. Actually, when at the National Oral Health Conference in 2009, the very first opportunity Pew had to talk to the larger dental public health community about our plans, it was a little breakfast meeting to see what people thought was going on, and Colonel Martin said that he announced that felt that his time in the Air Force was not going to be on many more years, and he wanted to make sure that we could get a new policy to reaffirm a policy that had actually lapsed. And so with some of Pew's assistance, he diligently worked on this effort. And the significance of this reaffirmation is that while the earlier policy was really related to protecting children that lived on military bases, this one was explicit in recognizing that the purpose of this policy was to protect the dental health of adults, whether that be service members or employees working on those bases. And of course, this has there are communities near military bases that have high regard for the military, and this is knowing this is useful in those efforts. And I think in many communities, there's a respect for the Department of Defense and their policies that some of those same ones that maybe didn't trust CDC might trust this. And on this, certainly CDC and the Department of Defense talk exactly the same line. So many people that are kind of absolutely dedicated, true believers in water fluoridation say, well, why don't we just mandate at the state level? We could pick some size community and just set the bar there. And the question is, well, haven't other states done it this way? Well, actually, this map there shows the states, the darker colors show states that have more coverage of water fluoridation. If you were to overlay the states that have mandates with that, you wouldn't see very much relationship, particularly in mandates since 1996. Before 1996, sure, very successful mandates. Since then, we've really had mixed results. Mandates, if you will, since 1996, starting with California, either include provisions for opt-out, are limited only to very large communities, or say you must fluoridate the water so long as somebody else pays. And so I've graded the outcomes of those six states here, and again, we can get into some of the details later on and why I grade them as such. One of the successes is Arkansas. This is a state that has established state mandate, if you will, since this Pew campaign started. But do realize that success builds on probably a decade of work from the oral health program in the state health department and the dental association. There was a new senator, state senator. He had been in the House, so we had a lot of contacts there. He was a new state senator, and he took that position the same year Pew had its first report card that gave an F to the state of Arkansas, and he wanted to change that. So he personally took it upon himself to promote and pass three pieces of legislation, one to allow physicians to get paid by Medicaid to provide oral health services to preschool children, another for hygienists to be able to seal teeth without a dentist having to do a prior exam, and the third was water fluoridation. But unlike a mandate where you would be asking people that had not fluoridated the water, communities that were not familiar with water fluoridation, to fluoridate and somehow make it look like the state was imposing something, because Arkansas was already 55% fluoridated, this really was able to take the issue of providing equity to make sure that everybody in the state would have the same benefits that were already being accrued by 55% of the people. And they projected that by drawing a line where they did with the community size, that they would move from 55% to 80%. The other thing was, while it included the you shall fluoridate so long as someone else pays for it, the Delta Dental Service Corporation had already come forward with a commitment to help fund this activity. So anybody that voted for this really couldn't be accused of expecting someone else to pay because that money had already been offered. And then finally, it was run as a true political legislative campaign, meaning that no detail was left unaddressed. Another way Pew's been working with states is to try to help reduce the financial burdens to communities, a very modest effort. And it comes from the an interaction of the federal government, the EPA's Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund, and the state. States typically match funds, but this is considered a budget-neutral kind of expenditure by the state because it's a loan program, and those monies are repaid. The monies go to local water systems that are updating their water system, and it can be those funds can be used to also either install for the first time fluoridation equipment or update old equipment. Nick Moskow from Mississippi was the first person to use this mechanism. It was his idea. We went to Louisiana, which had a quote mandate, but had virtually no success in getting places to fluoridate because of the financial barriers. Louisiana now has a provision in their loan revolving loan fund application. Again, it's modest. They only get 2 points for adding fluoridation equipment, and relative to the other points, it's not a lot. The emphasis really is on safe drinking water here, but you can see that for some community, not only might it make a difference in moving them up on the priority, it certainly allows them to fund their fluoridation efforts along with other efforts, and so the amount of expenditure for water fluoridation is almost imperceptible when you consider it in light of the larger efforts. And now Colorado has regulations that have been written, are now in the public comment phase. So that'll be in Louisiana, we're trying to find communities that are kind of recruiting communities to take advantage of this. And in Colorado, we'll begin those efforts next year when that regulation takes place. Now, I think our biggest threat is really the elephant in the room, if you will, are these rollbacks. And while Dr. Johnson mentioned that in many ways that those four different categories that he had were similar in terms of how we need to respond, I think these rollbacks are really highly leveraged by opponents of water fluoridation. The kind of argument is if places that have been fluoridating stop fluoridating, they must know something, they must realize it's not necessary or it's dangerous. And if they won't fluoridate, why would anybody else fluoridate? You've seen these statistics before. We're adding more people every year, more growth actually since the year 2000 than before, so why should we be concerned? Again, it's this issue of leveraging these decisions. And so as summarized in the New York Times, what would otherwise seem kind of a loony fringe kind of effort takes on this idea that it's now mainstream. It allows the opponents of water fluoridation to have much more measured promote this in a much more measured way, and it kind of reinforced this idea that somehow or another we don't need this anymore. Now, we are really doing better than the common perceptions. If our perceptions are generated by what Fluoride Alert has on its website, it's going to show you the number of communities. But if you actually look at the number of people, that have been involved with these decisions. You can see that almost every year we have more new people newly fluoridated through startups than we have people no longer receiving a fluoridation because of rollbacks. Of course, the Fluoride Action Network always kind of mixes these issues and brings in not just rollbacks, but places that declined to start fluoridation at all. And right in the middle of this decade was Nebraska, a very ill-considered state mandate law, very unsuccessful. More than 60 communities rejected water fluoridation because of that law. And so you could see that in terms of numbers of communities, that would make a much different look here of these trends. Now, Pew and AFTDD have actually been monitoring rollback decisions, threats, and what the final outcomes have. And for the last 2 years, we have won more, in other words, prevented more rollbacks than have been successful at a 2-to-1 margin. But that only occurs through great effort, the kind of effort that Dr. Johnson talked about. And as he said, it's pretty hard to respond if we don't even know what's going on. So Tennessee has in the last few years had a law to require a prior notice, so that some period of time would need to be taken to allow the community to provide input to the decision makers. We're currently working with the state of New York not only to require a prior notice, but to require that a plan be submitted. And the kind of plan would have to say, although it's been proposed by opponents of water fluoridation that there are better, cheaper ways to receive the same health benefits, you need to submit a plan showing that. And we're quite confident that when people actually look at the cost and the relative less effectiveness of some of the other options, they'll realize that water fluoridation is the way to go. Now, in addition to those state efforts, Pew did take a look to find nationally what we're up against. And about a year after the campaign started, we involved an expert on communications called Dr. Bill Smith. He came to a meeting with many fluoridation advocates, and he basically showed us a picture of a football field with no one on it. He said the proponents of water fluoridation have basically left the field. They declared victory and left the playing field, and that's an image I have in my mind. That's the complacent public health community. And as we've already heard, there's an ease of spreading false information online, and that's created this perfect storm. Again, appear to be unorganized, but actually quite organized, and it's been a coalition of the far left and the far right. Two communities couldn't be more different, Wichita and Portland, yet they had the same outcome. Public's generally not informed. Of the 20% that say they're well-informed, 10% of them have the wrong information, or half of them have the wrong information. So again, Bill Smith came up with this idea that we're really facing as something, think about this as a virus. A doubt virus. A virus, you know, that comes to a community suddenly, maybe from the outside, once it's there, it kind of spreads quickly. And then once it gets established, antibiotics don't help for a virus. And similarly, once people become scared, logic and reason don't necessarily work. So if we think about this as a virus, then our strategies need to be surveillance to anticipate what's going on, prevention, kind of thing Dr. Johnson was talking about, talking to people even before there's an issue, let them know what you think and that you're there for them. And then once there is a threat, moving quickly. The way we're supporting those efforts is through the Campaign for Dental Health, which has now been endorsed by over 80 organizations. We're trying to include more that are not kind of the typical dental groups. And one of the things that distinguishes the Campaign for Dental Health from, say, the websites of CDC and the ADA, which also have very good information, is that we made the decision to talk about the debate. There is a debate. It's not a debate over whether fluoride causes osteosarcoma or low IQs. It's not a debate over whether fluoride works. The debate is whether we're going to let people get in the way or get people to deny us in our community the benefits that we've been receiving from water fluoridation. Or if we have the idea to begin to experience those benefits, are there people that are going to deny us that? We have guidance for the messaging. The materials on ilikemyteeth.org are based on this notion that we need to use common language, and especially that we need to not be talking on focused on the message of the opponents. They want us to talk here on this, what's called the message wheel. They want us to talk about these things. We need to talk about these things. And ilikemyteeth.org provides you resources to do that. recently in August. There was an introduction of what's called the ShareSite Fluoride Kit Toolkit. It was a joint project of the National Network for Oral Health Access, which is basically the community health center dentists and dental staff, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. And so there's specific documents for each of these. These are kind of things that are intended to be shared with patients, but they're also, I think, very much the kind of things that Dr. Johnson mentioned can be shared with policymakers. To find those, go to the part of the ilikemyteeth.org that there's a health profession section. However you need to click on to get there, you'll find those documents there. They can be downloaded. And another thing we learned was that nationally, 18 to 34-year-olds are not supportive of water fluoridation. Again, if you think about it, they don't know what it was like before fluoride. They don't realize how much they have benefited from that. And so we need to use social media like Facebook and Twitter to get the message out. And in fact, that's where we need to go in the future. Pew will be leaving concluding its state efforts with regard to water fluoridation this coming year. But I hope we'll continue to work on these kinds of activities nationally. In fact, these are the kind of things all of us in this room should be working on. Thank you.
Excellent, Bill. Very, very well done. Wasn't this a great panel? I asked everyone to keep it to 15 minutes, and we essentially did that because, to me, getting these facts and information, the best time now is to see what you think, what are your concerns, what are your questions, what can we clarify. And I think I'm going to open a discussion with a question for Dr. Gooch. When the ANTIs did the Freedom of Information Act of CDC, one of the things they brought up was that there was an early memo saying that African Americans had more fluorosis. And prior to that, the ANTIs had got Reverend Andrew Young, who was one of Martin Luther King's key supporters and workers, and one of his daughters to come out against fluoridation. Because with African Americans, one, they claim there's more fluorosis, and two, they don't have the money if they're using infant formula to get the fluoride-free bottled water. So could you talk a little bit about, and the other thing is when you ask why do African Americans have more fluorosis, I think no one's really studied that. So if you could just say something about that for the audience to help us with that.
Well, the only published information we have on that was published in 2005 surveillance summary. And when you looked at the 1999 to the first four years of NHANES 99-2004, there was a surveillance summary that published in 2005, and it did confirm that among persons 6 to 49 at that time, that African Americans did have a higher prevalence of fluorosis. As I've stated, we're decreasing or recommending, proposed recommendation that the amount of fluoride in water be decreased for a number of reasons that I cited. We haven't really explored why that increase, why fluorosis is higher among African Americans than other racial and ethnic groups. There are generally three target or highlighted within the NHANES sampling, which is going to be the largest groups are going to be white, non-Hispanic, Mexican Americans at that time, and then African Americans. So there is considerations, I think, that the surveillance summary put forth, that there could be greater exposure to fluoride. There could be a difference in response. We know that the measurement of fluorosis can be highly subjective, so there could be a difference in how it's perceived by the examiners. But we don't have clear evidence as to why there would have been we don't have solid reasons that I can provide for you as to why the prevalence would be higher. Well, Myron's saying I actually don't have the data in front of me as to whether it was mostly mild fluorosis. I think it probably was mostly mild fluorosis. But again, I want to just leave you with the message that we're proposing that the fluoride in water be reduced, and the prevalence and severity of fluorosis may then again be reduced, while the preventive effects of fluoride for caries prevention is maintained.
Howard and Bill both want to answer that. Now, let me have Howard first, but I want to throw in another question so you can answer that as well. The Costco survey, roughly how many in the United States was surveyed, and then in Canada it was reversed. So if you could talk about the African-American fluorosis thing plus the Costco survey and what happened in Canada.
The only thing I'd like to add about individuals that have very mild or mild fluorosis is there's a lot of data to show that it's protective against tooth decay. It certainly is. When you're looking at fluoride, I think of it as a two-sided coin. That you can't consider fluoride in terms of its relationship with teeth without thinking both of caries and fluorosis. That's how it was always studied before 1945 with fluoridation, and we ought not to be ignorant of the fact that we are dealing with fluorosis as well as caries. So I don't have anything other than that to add on that particular topic. Myron correctly stated that in Canada, there's a Canadian version of Costco Connection. And there, the results were completely diametrically opposite, with an even greater majority of folks that voted voting against supporting water fluoridation. And I really do think it's as a result of the efforts that in the lower 48, as it were, that there was a greater effort by the American Dental Association to get out the word compared to perhaps the Canadian Dental Association. I really don't have the details on how it evolved. But interestingly, it evolved a couple of months prior to the American survey, yet we were ignorant of that here in the United States, as we often are about Canadian issues, having lived a year in Winnipeg. I think it's really truly reflective of the effort and health promotion by American Dental Association, other groups who are certainly on the Dental Public Health Listserv, as mentioned, and other places.
Do you know what the numbers were for the U.S. survey versus the U.S.?
No, we don't know how many people actually voted on this survey.
So to the issue of the prevalence of fluorosis among African Americans, the surveillance summary does include tables that show the that show the prevalence by type of fluorosis, level of severity of fluorosis by those three racial groups. So when someone says African Americans have a higher prevalence, what they're really saying is they have a lower prevalence of no fluorosis, because the thing we can all agree on is no fluorosis. But then when you say, okay, well, if they do have fluorosis, well, what is that like? Well, if you look at that in the levels of moderate and severe, there's no statistically significant difference between African American prevalence in African Americans or whites. Okay. How about that level of questionable fluorosis? Now, realize what that means. That means that an examiner, carefully trained examiner, having dried the tooth out and looked at it under a light, can't decide whether it's fluorosis or not. That can hardly be something that anyone would have any effect on anyone's life to have. And then next, there's a category of very mild fluorosis. Again, this is the level where the examiner, after they dry the tooth out and look at it under a light, can barely decide that indeed it's fluorosis. And that leaves us with mild fluorosis. Mild fluorosis, which a well-trained examiner can identify. The prevalence among white Americans in that age group is 4%. The prevalence among African Americans is 8%. So we have 4% more African Americans having this detectable white flecks on their teeth that has been associated with lower rates of tooth decay. So that is really the issue, in my mind, of what it means to say that African Americans have a higher prevalence of fluorosis. They have 4% more mild fluorosis, and it's protective of tooth decay.
Let me add to that. You get fluorosis in non-fluoridated communities. as well as in fluoridated communities. And usually when studies have been done as to fluorosis, they usually find it's because the child has eaten toothpaste while they were very young. And then the other second major reason for fluorosis in non-fluoridated communities is kids are getting double-dosed with fluoride pills or drugs. And I make it a point to say that when it comes up at a town meeting, because people think fluorosis is caused by fluoridation. It's caused by a variety of things, but most of it is usually caused by fluoride toothpaste. Let's open it up for questions. Could you stand and identify yourself?
Nancy Gilbert from Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm the chair of the Board of Health. And on the 5th of November, we beat the anti-fluoridation people. They were really talking about that's in the morning, changing our warrant article. So I know the battle's not over. But as a Board of Health, and we write the regulations for town, we are thinking of lowering our recommended fluoride in the water to 0.7. Do you have any comments? Because the formal recommendation isn't out yet.
You know, I understand that the situation is not entirely. I understand the situation is not entirely clear, but I guess I would state that the standing recommendation is 0.7 to 1.2, as I indicated. We are moving forward in the clearance procedures with the recommendations document. We've provided the reasons supporting the 0.7 milligrams per liter. I also would refer you to the EPA scientific assessments. I just want to highlight again that EPA has changed its health endpoint from stage 3 crippling skeletal fluorosis to severe dental fluorosis. And that is something that we'll probably be, we'll learn more about over the coming months and year.
So, you know, in Massachusetts last year, we have 7 communities that questioned fluoridation or wanted to do a rollback. One of them fluoridated for more than 50 years. We won all of those. This year, we have 15 challenges and questions, and I think it's going to be even more. Kathy Latoury, who's chair of the oral health section, we work very closely together to fight it back in Lincoln, Massachusetts, a high socioeconomic community, very well educated. And the anti's have foothold. Questions from the audience? Questions, yes.
Yeah, I'm Carol Curtello from Yolo County, California. Dr. Pollack was very helpful in our loss of the battle, but not the not the war.
Good job.
Good job, Howard.
Yeah. In Yolo County, we were trying to coordinate 2 communities, one of which is Davis, California, the Republic of Davis. Very libertarian community. And my question is, we're going kind of taking a step back from the political arena after our political loss with the city council in Davis, and trying to build more of a grassroots support, particularly among dental and health professionals. So my question is, what are dentists learning in dental school, or where are they in their support? Because we have, you know, tried to elicit their support, and we got maybe, you know, 30% support among practicing dentists, and we thought we were disappointed.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. What if, you know, is it a financial thing not to have fluoridated? I mean, I don't know. We couldn't figure that one out.
So let me address, first of all, that the special committee that was set up by the Davis City Council to review all the evidence and make a recommendation to the City Council recommended unanimously to support water moving forward with water fluoridation. The politics of the situation prevented the City Council from moving forward. In Sonoma County, we're faced with a similar challenge, and very close to Yolo County. And there, the Board of Supervisors approved moving forward with fluoridation. They had this aquatic assessment of the fish, and we've passed that hurdle. We also have a contract now with the Sonoma County Healthcare Agency to educate the healthcare professionals in Sonoma County. By and large, it's an issue. It's the empty football field that was described in terms of where dentists are these days. The perception is that many years ago was that the caries battle has been won. And so there is less enthusiasm, less support in curricula in dental schools for educating dentists about water fluoridation. At UCSF, where I work, Ernie Newman for many years had a very extensive course on caries and fluorides. We had rotations of seminars with students in small groups, and that has gone by the way. We had a fluoride debate thing, that's gone by the way. They now learn how to place implants. Maybe I'll end on that.
There are some schools that teach about fluoridation and fluorides, and more so at Tufts. They do a fluoridation debate. I do a fluoridation debate where I have the students debate each other, and then the students critique and take a vote. I do the same thing at the BU School of Dentistry with the graduate students there. I recently wrote an article in the Mass Dental Society Journal called Fluoridation Update 2014. And at the end of that article, I made recommendations. And one of them was that every dentist in every fluoridated community, when they do a treatment plan on a new patient, should say, thank goodness you were brought up in a fluoridated community, you have much less tooth decay, and you'll have lower dental bills. And then in a non-fluoridated community, they say to the patient, it's unfortunate that you were brought up in a non-fluoridated community because you're going to have more disease and infection and higher bills. If we could get every dentist, or at least 40, 50, or 60% to do that, in every community, I think we'd be much more ahead of the game. We had a fluoridation fight in a small community, Groveland, in Massachusetts, and I heard about it, and there were only two dentists in the community. And I called the one I knew I had as a student. I said, you're going to have a fluoridation fight, the people are voting. He said, not a problem. I said, well, the ENT superintendent, he says, I've been telling my patients about fluoridation since I graduated dental school. He said, you don't have to do anything. And sure enough, we won overwhelmingly in that community. People trust their dentists, but if they don't speak up and they hear it from the ENTs for the first time, it causes a problem. A couple more questions? Elaine?
When I moved to...
Could you stand up and identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm going to stand up.
Oh, she is. Sorry.
Okay.